This is Deborah Beck, professor of ancient Greek literature in the Department of Classics at the University of Texas at Austin. My students and I are excited to welcome you to our podcast, Musings in Greek Literature.
Welcome to episode 3 of Musings with Greek 365, a podcast created by the students of an upper division Greek course taught by Deborah Beck at the University of Texas at Austin. My name is Sam Ross, an undergraduate in the class, and I will be talking about the end of Book 22 of the Iliad, specifically lines 442 through 448, as well as lines 460 through 467. The class and this podcast series focus on the final three books of the poem, where Achilles' Menis is finally fulfilled and its aftermath is dealt with. In episode 2 of this podcast, Ethan Russo discussed Achilles' speech after he killed Hector. In the Iliad, however, the victor isn't the only one whose reaction we get to witness. The rest of Book 22, and much of Book 24 as well, centers around the laments of Hector's family as they grieve and recognize their own inevitable fates without manslaying Hector to defend them. We are going to be focusing on Andromache and her anxieties and fears as she learns of her husband Hector's fate and imagines what the future may be like for her and her son Astyanax. Priam and Hecuba have just delivered their laments, having watched the battle and the fall of their son. Andromache, however, is still inside, where Hector told her to go back in Book 6, and she is getting ready for her noble husband's return. It is with this scene that I would like to begin. At the beginning of this passage, Andromache is inside weaving a tapestry, which is what Hector told her to do last time we saw her in Book 6. We, the audience, already know Hector is dead, but Andromache is still in blissful ignorance, even ordering her two slaves to draw water to ready a hot bath for when Hector returns. Now, the narrator of the poem is often spoken of as an impartial and objective observer. But this notion doesn't hold up to a closer reading of the text. It is clear in the passage we will discuss how the narrator can exert his own agency onto unfolding events, influencing the situation and our response to it. Rather than just list what happens, he includes exclamations meant to color our interpretation of the passage. For example, when Andromache orders a hot bath for Hector after he returns from battle, the words maches eknostesanti are used. This phrase is used only in situations where the subject never comes back, but has in fact died in battle. This is something the audience already knows, but the phrase serves to highlight Andromache's ignorance. The very next line furthers this observation. In English, this reads, "Poor fool, she didn't even know just how far he was from the bathwaters." The use of the words "poor fool," my rendering of the Greek word napié, stresses that ignorance. But it also tells those of us listening how we are supposed to feel about it. Her naivety is pitiable and pathetic. We are told to empathize with her. The idea that he is far from the bathwaters evokes the distance between Andromache's expectations and reality. But it is also a more literal statement in that washing the corpse was an essential part of mourning rituals, rituals which at this point seem unlikely to happen as Hector is dragged away behind Achilles' chariot. It is at this moment that she hears wailing from the tower outside and starts to get an inkling of what's happened. She gives a speech to her slaves about how fearful she is that Achilles might have killed her husband, alone and far from the city walls. This speech is immediately followed by a line, which I will read in Greek. Hos famene megaroia dies sutamainadise. That is, speaking in this way, she darted from the hall in a frenzy. The verb, diesuta, is aorist, pointing both to the hurry she was in to get out of the tower, and to her heightening fear and worry for her husband. The participle concluding the speech was present tense, though, famene. This combination of aorist verb and present participle implies that she gave this speech while rushing out the door. She has gone from a state of happy ignorance to one of acute and paralyzing fear. This is brought home by the completely dactylic nature of the line, the bum-bum-bum-bum-bum-bum rhythm. The quick pace of the line mirrors her emotional state. Listen to the line again. Hos famene megaroya diesuta maina deise. This is another way in which the narrator has inserted his own perspective into the narrative. There is no way hearing this that we don't empathize completely with Andromache's plight. Once she has left her chambers, the narrator stalls as long as possible her revelation of Hector's corpse. She comes out and, standing still, looks around. Only then does she notice the body of her husband being dragged away by Achilles' chariot. Here, too, the narrator repeats the fact that Hector is dragged twice, adding the second time that it is by swift horses moving in an akedestos way. This word, akedestos, appears many times in the epic, but only here is it said by the narrator. The word is often translated as randomly or even recklessly, but it also carries the connotation of remaining unburied, a worry always at the forefront of a Homeric hero's mind. And this is what Andromache finds so terrifying. Her husband has been killed, and his mangled body is now being taken farther and farther from her. She will later lament that she will not be able to give him the proper mourning rituals, such as bathing the corpse and dressing it in a shroud. By the narrator's use of the word akedestos, he is validating Andromache's fear. The last thing I want to note here is the following two lines. Lines 466 and 467, if you're following along. As soon as Andromache sees the mistreatment of her husband's corpse, she faints. The language used to describe this fainting, however, is the language of death. The notion introduced a few lines later, when she says that the two of them were born to a single fate, might then imply that, with Hector's death, Andromache herself experiences a death of her own. This is a suggestion which I owed to one of my peers in the class, but I think it makes a lot of sense. The expressions and the blackness of night covered over her eyes, as well as she fell backwards and breathed out her soul, are both common in death scenes on the battlefield. What is unique is the pairing of them here. Most heroes, when they actually die, get one or the other phrase, but here we have a two-line expansion of this theme to illustrate how real this metaphorical death is to Andromache. In summary, throughout this scene, the narrator uses particular language and arrangements in order to stress Andromache's grief and get the listeners to empathize with her. He is in no way an impartial observer, but an active participant in shaping the narrative and our response to it. While this might be particularly noticeable in this scene, it certainly isn't unique to it. As you continue or start reading the Iliad, look for those moments that make you think, why did the poet put it that way? How does this change how I understand what's going on? What message am I supposed to be receiving? This was the lesson I taught to my peers as their teacher for the day. In teaching this lesson, I hope not just to think about the text, but to think about how we think about the text. By this, I mean looking a bit more closely at the sometimes dry process of textual criticism. Jumping forwards a bit from where we just left off, the authenticity of lines 487 through 499 near the end of Book 22 have been debated since antiquity. The lines discuss Andromache's prediction for the misery of her son Astyanax, orphaned by Hector's death. Aristarchus, a Hellenistic scholar who wrote commentaries on the Homeric poems, among others, thought these lines should be anathematized, or taken out, because the idea of Hector's son being so ill-treated when his uncles were still alive seemed unthinkable. His reasoning has been variously picked up and expanded upon, or otherwise rejected by modern commentators. The lines detail a scenario in which Astyanax is robbed of his lands by others, made to cry constantly, and denied admittance to feasts with the cruel words, "Get out of here. Your father doesn't dine with us anymore." What I had wanted for us to do as a class was to examine on what grounds we might doubt the lines and whether we should let our own aesthetic expectations dictate the authenticity of the text. My peers seemed to enjoy discussing the passage, its incongruence within the context, and their own cultural biases and expectations of what an epic poem ought to be. While only one student thought the lines should indeed be anathematized, all thought the lines a bit jarring, and came up with many good suggestions as to why the poet would have Andromache dwell on such an unrealistic scenario. Perhaps to stress the fatherlessness, or to make the emotion Andromache is expressing more concrete to Homer's contemporary audience. Teaching this lesson was a really interesting experience for me. It was much more dynamic than I really expected. It was hard to stick to any lesson plan, and I had to keep adapting on the fly as we spent more time discussing one element of the text or another. We didn't get to all the things I had planned to talk about, but only because we ended up discussing other interesting questions which I hadn't really considered. This did force a kind of time pressure at the end, and our discussion of Aristarchus was a bit hurried. This is a problem I can fix going forwards. I was also forced to engage with the text in a way I don't normally do. Rather than merely understanding what the text says, I had to examine why the poet said things in this particular way, as well as other ways of expressing shades of meaning besides the literal denotation of the words used. The meter, word order, diction, and tone all influence how we should interpret the poem. Teaching this passage brought home the heart-wrenching grief of a widow with an uncertain future more than just translating it for homework ever could. I found this to be a very valuable experience. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Sam Ross, and this was episode 3 of Musings with Greek 365. I hope you enjoyed it, and thank you for listening. If you have any lingering questions or concerns, please let me know in the comments below. And tune in next time for Claudia Cockrell discussing the beginning of book 23.